Some other news now. A new study explores a question that has occurred to almost anybody who's looked at an expensive bottle of wine and wondered if it was really that much better than the one that costs a few bucks. As NPR's Allison Aubrey reports, the answer may depend on your biology.
When I got the assignment to look into the science of wine-tasting subtleties, the obvious place to go was a wine shop.
You are in Schneider's of Capitol Hill, and my name is John Genderson.
As we navigate the narrow rows of his shop, I ask Genderson if he could find us a wine that the experts of the wine world, the people who come up with those ratings, absolutely love.
There's quite a few.
He places his hand on the neck of one bottle.
A Charme Chambertin from this great producer, Domaine du Blair.
And the price tag?
It's $150.
Oh,
Charme
wow.
Chambertin Grand Cru.
Okay,
so $150. That one's very, very expensive, very highly rated and very expensive.
Genderson says in the high-end wine world, ratings really do drive prices and trends. And reviews are based on a complicated vocabulary that lots of us pretend to understand.
It's soft. The tannins are balanced and integrated into the wine. It has lovely fruit.
But as Genderson talks in this language of wine, I realize to some extent he's lost me. I mean, sure, I can fake it, but honestly, I don't know how to detect notes of plum or eucalyptus. Now, it's possible that with some training, I could learn. But it's also possible that what separates me from experts like Genderson is a matter of biology as well. That's what scientist John Hayes thinks.
It may be that he actually has different physiology in his mouth and nose and brain that allows him to pick out some of those nuances that no matter how much training you have, you'll never find.
Well, okay. But Hayes and some of his colleagues at Penn State have just published a study that offers some proof of this theory, that in the world of wine tasting, there are super tasters, and then there are the rest of us.
Well, we evaluated about 330 wine drinkers with a specific bitter chemical that measures tasteability. And when we did that, we found that the wine experts, people like winemakers or wine judges or wine writers, were much more sensitive to the bitterness of this chemical.
It's similar to the studies that have found super tasters are more sensitive to the sweetness of sugar, the spiciness of chilies, or saltiness of chips. So if it turns out that lots of us don't or can't taste the subtleties of fine wines, it makes me wonder, why do people pay for them? Outside the wine shop, I asked a group of law students, including Jim Stanton.
I think a lot of times when you pay more for a bottle, you sometimes don't want to admit to yourself that it's not something good.
But now that we know that lots of us can't taste the difference, maybe we won't feel insecure about sticking with our more economically priced favorites. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Federal health officials have issued a new report about a dangerous bacterial infection. Despite years of efforts, the infection is continuing to spread rapidly. The report calls on hospitals, nursing homes, and doctors' offices to fight it more aggressively, as NPR's Rob Stein reports.
The infection is called Clostridium difficile, or C. diff. It can cause severe diarrhea and other life-threatening complications. Clifford McDonald is with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
It is a bacterium that also happens to form spores. It produces toxins that affect the colon, the large intestine.
According to the CDC, the number of Americans getting infected and hospitalized with C. diff has more than tripled, and the number dying has quadrupled in recent years. About 14,000 Americans die each year from C. diff.
It is now at historic highs.
C. diff tends to hit people who are taking antibiotics for some other illness. The antibiotics wipe out beneficial microbes, increasing the chances C. diff will make them sick.
Sometimes we talk about this as a 1-2 punch.
Ironically, pretty much all C. diff cases can be traced to an encounter with the healthcare system. Here's how it can happen.
They come in contact with C. difficile, maybe directly from the environment, a patient bed rail or something like that, or a healthcare worker may carry it to them on their hands. Then that patient, wherever that organism now is living on their skin perhaps, they touch their face, they swallow it, it passes into their intestines where it develops, causes symptoms and disease.
Doctors had long thought most people get C. diff from hospitals, but it turns out that half of patients who have C. diff are already infected before they get to the hospital.
This is a problem not just in hospitals, but wherever healthcare is being delivered. Now, very commonly in nursing homes and outpatient settings.
So federal officials are urging healthcare workers to take several measures to try to stop C. diff from spreading. For one thing, doctors can use antibiotics a lot more sparingly. And once a patient has been diagnosed,
get them in isolation, a separate patient room, separate bathroom, and then use gloves and gowns to prevent contaminating the hands of the healthcare provider and carrying it to another patient.
McDonald says healthcare facilities should also sterilize everything an infected patient has come into contact with. That's because the C. diff spores can hang around for months.
And it's that spore which is the infective form.
Despite the sobering trends, McDonald says he's optimistic. Dozens of hospitals around the country have beaten back their C. diff infection rates by being more aggressive. Rob Stein, NPR News.
All Things Considered continues in a moment. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The film version of The Hunger Games comes out in a few weeks. It's based on the best-selling young adult novel of the same name, set in a dystopian post-apocalyptic world. The hype around the movie has pushed sales of The Hunger Games trilogy to new heights. And as NPR's Lynn Neary reports, publishers are eagerly churning out more novels with similar settings.
In the beginning, The Hunger Games was not considered a sure thing. Why would it be? It's the story of a world where teenagers are forced to fight each other to the death in a game that's broadcast and watched everywhere, like a reality TV show. David Levithan, editorial director at Scholastic, which publishes the books, says the company took a risk on The Hunger Games because they trusted the writer, Suzanne Collins. It wasn't until Collins turned in the first manuscript that Levithan understood what he had.
It came in on a Friday, and I and the other two editors working on it read it over the weekend, and then that Monday we just looked at each other and said, wow.
Now there are more than 26 million copies of all the Hunger Games books in print in the U.S., and all three books consistently top the bestseller lists. The film version of the book stars Jennifer Lawrence as Katniss, the courageous young heroine who volunteers to take part in the games in order to save her little sister from that fate.
Our tributes, Peter Mullark and Katniss Everdeen.
They just want a good show. That's all they want.
There's 24 of us, Gail. Only one comes out.
Dystopian fiction has been around for a long time, but the success of The Hunger Games has spawned a whole new crop of books set in a grim future where an authoritarian regime is just begging to be overthrown. These books are aimed straight at a teenage audience.
Dystopia is the new vampire, for sure.
Sarah Petrie is not a teenager, but she loves young adult fiction and writes about it on her website, Forever Young Adult. Look in the young adult section of any bookstore and you'll see shelves full of these books. Some of them even have covers that clearly imitate The Hunger Games. Petrie says there's always a hero or heroine, no older than the early 20s, faced with a life or death situation in a post-apocalyptic world.
You know, it's fun to see so many books try to guess how the world will end. I mean, there's supervolcanoes been very popular, virus is very popular, nuclear bombs very popular, but it is kind of fun to see writers trying to stretch and be like, what else could happen? What other terrible tragedy could occur?
It's kind of an alternate history of the United States in which love has actually been declared a contagious disease.
Lauren Oliver says she never intended to be part of a dystopian fiction trend. She just wanted to explore the idea of a society that views love as a disease and forces its citizens to be cured of it at the age of 18. Pandemonium, the second book in her trilogy, has just been released. Oliver says young people today can identify with the characters in these kinds of stories.
The young protagonists are inheriting this kind of dark and broken world, and with a little bit of pluck and courage have to navigate it and try to salvage some kind of happy ending. And I do think there's a lot of parallels to how young people kind of feel nowadays as they're confronting this future, which is very uncertain in this country economically, and they're inheriting what they see as kind of a broken world.
The best of these books, says Sarah Petrie, offer richly imagined visions of a world changed forever by a cataclysmic disaster. In Juliana Baggett's Pure, a massive bombing leaves survivors forever fused to whatever they were doing at the moment of the detonations. Petrie says it's a riveting device.
I loved how gross the mutations were in her book. She had a doll's head for her hand. She had the guy she likes has, like, birds in his back. It was really fascinating and gross. It's like a train wreck. You can't look away.
Rebellion plays a big role in these books, says Petrie, and it helps to have what she calls swoon, that is, a hot romance. Most are action-packed. Some, like the Chaos Walking trilogy by Patrick Ness, are violent.
If you think Suzanne Collins is mean in Hunger Games with all the people she kills, just wait till you meet Patrick Ness. I mean, he will make you cry. I cried so much reading all three books, but I found them to be absolutely amazing.
Not everyone is as big a fan of these books as Petrie. David Levithan, understandably, has a warm place in his heart for The Hunger Games, but he's not convinced that dystopian fiction will knock the vampire off its young adult perch.
I, as a reader, when I finish a dystopian novel, I just want to go read Pride and Prejudice. I feel that if you sat there and only read about broken worlds over and over again, I think it would get a little bleak and tiresome. So I'm not quite sure people are just reading this in the same way that they were like, oh, I'm just going to read vampire romance over and over again.
Of course, a dystopian world with vampires, that's another story. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Here's a fact that may reveal something that's going on in the country. The population of the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., has gone up by about 40,000 over the last decade, and yet the number of cars has not climbed. It turns out that in many places across the country, more people are beginning to opt out of ownership of cars. They may share vehicles instead, for example, and not just through established companies like Zipcar. Charlotte Baer reports now that some startup companies are helping owners to start renting their own cars out to complete strangers.
For a lot of people, it would be tough to let a stranger drive off with one of your most valuable possessions. Not so for Stanford graduate student Katie Hagee.
This was a great option to at least slow the hemorrhaging of money that is business school.
She makes an extra $150 a month by renting out her car through Wheels, spelled with a Z. The Silicon Valley startup allows her to name a price for others to borrow her silver BMW when it would otherwise just sit there in a campus parking lot. She's so happy about the cash, she doesn't even mind when people adjust her seats in stereo.
There was one time when the seat was really low and it was playing rap, like really, really loud. And so I thought that was pretty comical because this isn't really a red and low car. It's a little chic sedan.
Hagee explains people access her girly mobile a lot like a Zipcar or other shared vehicle. It's just that the car is owned by an individual and not a company.
I've got my card, and I'm going to put that up to the sensor on the dashboard. And then all I'm going to do is I'm going to reach across to the glove box, and there's a Wheels box that I recognize, and I open that.
So then you have your key there,
yep.
And then you just pop it in and drive away.
And drive away.
One of those people driving off is undergraduate Jesse Clayburg. He doesn't have his own car and dreads trekking to a rental counter just to pay extra because he's under 25. With Wheels, he can pick from more than 24 different cars right there on campus. That came in handy when he picked up a pretty girl at the airport.
And I may or may not have been trying to impress such lady friend. And what I found was an Audi TT. You know, which is a small two-seater, a little coupe that goes pretty fast. She was very impressed.
There is a massive migration from ownership of assets to purchasing a service that helps you achieve the same end that you would if you owned that good.
Wheels founder Jeff Miller says people already loan cars to their friends and family. His company just makes it safer and easier. The service screens customers to make sure their driving records are clean, and members have to sign up through Facebook, so rentals aren't completely anonymous.
It's actually a very personal transaction, and people sort of respect the fact that it's another person's car. We've had zero claims to date and thousands of reservations, and so far, so good.
But this so-called peer-to-peer car sharing is still new. Wheels just launched last year. So did GetAround, a city-based service in San Francisco. Relay Rides and Jolly Wheels have been operating on the East Coast a little longer, but not much.
This is an uncertain and unknown and developing area.
That's Susan Shaheen. She's a transportation researcher at UC Berkeley.
There's a lot of excitement and interest in it, but I think it's important not to put too many expectations on it as it's starting out.
She says the concept faces several hurdles. A big one is clarifying insurance laws. Another is developing a profitable business model. Shaheen estimates peer-to-peer car sharing could be in the black within 5 years if it increases its cut of the revenue. Right now, car owners get at least 60%. That's a fair split as far as Katie Hagee is concerned. After all, she's the one putting her car on the line.
At this point, if the car got a dent and the dent was fixed, that's fine for me. We'd be having a different conversation if the car was totaled.
Big companies, including GM and Zipcar, have taken notice of peer-to-peer sharing and invested millions in these startups. That's fueling some ambitious expansion plans. Wheels just rolled out at UC Berkeley this week and expects to launch at 2 more campuses by the end of the month. For NPR News, I'm Charlotte Baer in Silicon Valley.
The city of Elkhart, Indiana, is known as the RV capital of the world.
Not such a great thing to be 3 years ago when the recession hit and demand for recreational vehicles came to a screeching halt. Elkhart saw its unemployment rate soar to 20%, which was the highest in the nation at that time.
President Obama has gone to Elkhart twice, promising stimulus funding to kickstart the manufacturing of electric vehicles. As NPR's David Shaper reports, those jobs haven't materialized, but the economy of Elkhart is slowly recovering.
From the outside, the Think Electric Vehicle Factory in Elkhart, Indiana, looks deserted. There's not a single car in the parking lot. The doors are all locked, the windows dark. It's not until you wander all the way around to the back of this 200,000-square-foot facility that there's a sign of life. One door left slightly ajar. And inside, several dozen brightly colored tiny electric cars sit in neat rows. Rodney Smith is the supervisor of this plant for the company Think EV.
All these cars are finished.
All of these, the red and the black ones?
Red, blue, and black. They're all finished. They're ready to go. We could hop in one of these and go down the road right now.
There are about 120 of these road-ready models called the Think City, a little two-seat, fully electric coupe that has a range of about 100 miles before it needs to be recharged. Smith says there are 32 more cars, not yet fully assembled, waiting for parts to come in. When they do, he and another worker finish putting the cars together.
That's currently what we're doing. We're just in a standby position, and we're continuing to sell cars. We're continuing to produce cars. It's just the two of us that are here.
That's right, just two employees work in this plant. It's a far cry from the more than 400 the Think company promised to hire 2 years ago. Backed by federal stimulus funding, Think announced plans to produce thousands of electric cars in Elkhart. Other companies promised to make cars and trucks and their parts here, too. As Elkhart County set out to jumpstart its flatlining economy with electric vehicles.
Our goal is to be the capital of this potentially massive industry of tomorrow.
That's Indiana's Republican Governor Mitch Daniels in his 2010 State of the State address. But 2 years later, Elkhart's electric buzz has all but gone bust. Some of the startups never started up. There are batteries and electric trucks being made, but at nowhere near the level anticipated. Think has only sold about 200 of the cars assembled at Elkhart, while its parent company, Think Global of Norway, filed for bankruptcy last summer.
They're still here, but the results were not anywhere near what we thought they would be.
That's Elkhart Mayor Dick Moore.
I thought there could be 1,000 jobs in that plant as this thing took off.
Clearly, that hasn't happened.
Perhaps we as Americans just can't get over the enjoyment, the love that we have to get behind the wheel of a big, powerful automobile. Maybe that's a part of our problem. I don't know.
But even those interested in driving small, quiet electric vehicles have concerns about the battery life and the range, as well as the cost. The Think cars are rather expensive for such a tiny little thing, more than $40,000 before government tax credits and incentives. Think has a troubled financial history, too, and faces growing competition in the electric car market. Meanwhile, there's been a surprisingly strong rebirth of sorts in what had been a moribund industry making recreational vehicles.
This is a one-of-a-kind machine.
Steve Bowen is showing off a new saw that is cutting pieces of composite siding for RVs on the floor of the Vixen Composites factory in Elkhart.
We make a lightweight composite panel. We can paint it any color you want it. We can cut it any size you want it.
Demand for such RV components is up, and many factories in and around Elkhart are humming once again and hiring.
Rumors of our demise have been greatly exaggerated.
Greg Foer is president of Vixen's parent company, the DiCorp Corporation, and is also chairman of the Recreational Vehicle Industry Association. Four says the industry's downturn was brutal, with business falling off close to 60%. But demand for RVs, he says, has come back strong. Last year, the industry produced more than 250,000 RVs. That's 100,000 more units than the low water mark in 2009. And Ford believes the market for motorhomes, travel trailers, and campers is here to stay.
People are still going to enjoy the lake, their kids, their relatives, the other campers, their beer, their ball games, their hot dogs. It's the way it's going to be.
Among the lessons of the deep recession, RV manufacturers now offer more lower-cost models, as well as more lightweight, fuel-efficient, and green RVs. But one thing that hasn't changed, says Ford, is that the fortunes of this city of 51,000 just south of the Michigan border are intricately linked to this one industry. How much so? Consider this. Nearly half of all of the jobs in Elkhart County are in manufacturing. In fact, no county in the country has a greater share of its jobs in manufacturing than Elkhart. And fully half of the manufacturing jobs here are in the making of RVs and their parts. Turning to electric vehicles to try to diversify the economy made some sense, as Elkhart is centrally located, has plenty of factory space, a supply chain in place, and a ready workforce.
It was a risk.
But Dorinda Hayden-Guss of Elkhart County's Economic Development Corporation says at the time it was a risk worth taking.
We were the highest unemployment rate in the entire country. We did not have any other opportunities of this significance that we were pursuing at the time.
Hayden-Guss and others hope Indiana-made electric cars can still take off. But the heavy focus on this new, unproven industry rubs some in Elkhart the wrong way.
It didn't work out. It's obvious it didn't work out.
Michael Pierce is an account manager for a supplier to the RV industry, enjoying a beer and a burger at a popular Elkhart bar called Wings, etc.
You know, the president comes here, and no disrespect to the president, but, you know, when you got the leader of the whole country here, and he's promising you this and promising you that, and it doesn't happen, it's pretty disheartening.
Actually, the administration delivered what it promised, grants to companies wanting to make electric vehicles. It's those companies that haven't delivered the jobs. And others say Elkhart needed to try something new, as the economy here still suffers. On Friday nights like this one, Wings used to be packed with a line out the door. But on this night, there are still several empty tables. Mark Elliott, who works in maintenance at a manufacturing plant, says the recent uptick in Elkhart is somewhat disappointing.
I think the problem with our economy here is the jobs are coming back, but the wages is almost cut in half. Am I right? I mean, you go back from, you had a job of $1,200 a week, and now you're going back to $600 a week. So what good did that do you?
And others around Elkhart say while there are now many fewer people out of work, they're still nervous about the future. With gas prices headed up, they worry that the RV industry, and thus the economy here in Elkhart, could tank again. David Shaper, NPR News.
At the height of the famine in Somalia last summer, we spoke with that country's most famous musician. The rapper Kanan had visited a refugee camp 20 years after his family fled Somalia when he was just 13. Much of Kanan's music, beginning with his first album, Dusty Foot Philosopher, flows from those days. He's joined us again to talk about his next album. Featuring collaborations with the likes of Nas and Bono, Kanan tried to write less about Somalia, but...
It's kind of in most of my melodic structure. There's a song I have called Bulletproof Pride, and the chorus comes on, and the chorus... I've been waiting for you to come to your senses, holding up your heavy heart down there in the trenches. That melody alone, that da na 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 la 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 la, is a very Somali feeling.
American rappers singing about the streets have nothing on Kanan, given his childhood in a Somalia that was violently breaking down. And in one new song, Coming to America, Kanan offers his take on the 1980s comedy where Eddie Murphy stars as the Prince of Zamunda, who comes to America in search of a wife and gets a cultural shock. I shoot you not, ain't afraid. Life gave me a rotten lemonade. Blew up my school in the eighth grade while playing catch with a hand grenade. Yep, that's a true story. This ain't Hollywood glory. I ain't the Prince of Zamunda, dog. My life is too gory. I'm tired of always going to very high.
There's a couple of things in this song. You rhyme Hollywood glory with gory. You also say that you used a hand grenade when you were in the eighth grade.
Did you really
blow up your school with a hand grenade?
Yeah, by accident. You know, we use what's called lah, which is a wooden slate in which you like write real ink. So every day, at the end of the day, the teacher chooses three students that wash the ink from the wood. And so at one point, we emptied some dirty water onto the ground, and it revealed this hand grenade. But, you know, at first instinct, we didn't know what it was. And one of us unpinned it, and I ended up having to throw it just in time that it blew up the school. And luckily, it was after school.
That is a real Mogadishu story.
Yeah, exactly. It was the kind of thing that when I came to consciousness, the dust is over me and I'm kind of looking for my friends and my ears are ringing and I'm thinking, I hope everyone is okay and everyone is alive. And the second thing, I really hope Mom doesn't find out about this. You know, I'm going to be in big trouble.
Were you?
No, my mom was, you know, took me in her arms and cried at the possibility that I could have been killed. Then she started going on a tangent. I was, what kind of a person would leave grenade in the playground of a school?
Yeah. There's a story, I gather, of your grandfather, who was your mother's father, and he was a renowned poet. Somalia has a long history of oral poetry, and the story is that he stopped a war with his words.
Yeah, that's the story. And they say that those two subclans had never fought again. The poetry I grew up on is really pure and powerful.
Is there even a line or two that you could recite for us in the language?
Well, there's another poem that my grandfather has. It's called The 12-Year-Old. It starts with, Wilhadu labit tabanjiru. I can't find the end of that sentence the way he did. Wilhadu labit tabanjiru. This is the kind of time when one should just call their mother on the phone. He's saying, if a boy is reached the age of 12 and cannot settle a traveling community, cannot shelter them and feed them, he has lost his opportunity for his manhood. And that's at 12, you know. This one, the years are a little different for us, I think.
Where do you think you would be now if you had not left Mogadishu when you were a boy?
Well, the examples aren't very good of the friends and family that I left behind, because the options were very limited. I mean, you joined a militia or some religious group, or you went to where the pirates are or something. For young men my age now, there aren't really a lot of options in Somalia. And I'm particularly like a hot-blooded character. I mean, I don't know that I would have been wise enough to have survived all these years.
Well, you do speak about a certain duality contained within yourself in the track More Beautiful Than Silence. Mm. You say, I know you think I'm righteous, but I'm also into rifles. Yeah. It may be surprising, even stunning, from a musician like yourself you've been an activist, you've visited refugee camps, you know how dark the world of weapons can be.
Yeah. That was a self-criticism, a moment in which I'm also recognizing those things, that I have moments of darkness and moments of anger and moments of rage, and they do creep up at the most inopportune times. And not to recognize that in my music would give people a sense of sainthood that I don't necessarily have or even want to have, because I don't accept the title of the all-great, you know, kid who came out of Mogadishu completely unfazed, unscathed, and has written music of just hope and joy. It can be partly true, but it isn't all true.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
the rapper Kanan. His newest album, Country, God, or the Girl, comes out this spring. Could be more beautiful than silence. Yeah. Silence. Okay. Ain't it funny how the talkers always talking? Never firing, but always say they cocking. And they cocky until they in the parking lot. Suddenly they got Parkinson's, they can hardly talk. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.